Should a symphony not express those things for which there are not words, but which need to be expressed? Tchaikovsky's own words to Moss, writing about the Fourth Symphony. And my feeling is that's sort of QED at the end of it, because that's exactly what a symphony should do. Express those thoughts that words cannot do. And I think he does it brilliantly in this symphony. It's one that I think is unfortunately, we might say, overshadowed rather than underrated by the fifth and sixth. They're the ones that everybody knows. But the Fourth Symphony is a magnificent piece of music. And it's certainly an awful lot better than the first, second and third. It marked a real move forward for Tchaikovsky and increasing maturity and so forth. And also I think it does show up the turmoil that was going on in his life at the time. He was trying to come to terms with his sexuality. He had married this student who declared her undying love for him. He had the marriage was breaking up, and he had just established relationships with his patroness who gave him a stipend for whatever many years afterwards, but. The turmoil shows up, I think, particularly in the first movement. The first movement itself could be a symphony, and it goes on for something like 18 minutes. And it starts with the horns, the trumpets, all sorts of fireworks, huge solos for the clarinet as well. But really, it comes to a rousing finish there as well, and then moves on into other movements. And of course, one of the most fascinating movements for me in this is the third movement, where it's all pizzicato, where they're just plucking away at the strings the whole time. It's magnificent, then comes to a rousing finish at the end. Now, I'm not sure you agree with me about the final movement.
Well, I suppose we'll see when we hear it this evening how they're playing it, but I think, you know, I'd riposte with his idea that an artist leads a double life. You know, one of his most famous quotes, you know, he lives the life of an ordinary person and the life of an artist, you know. And when I look at this symphony, I'm thinking, yeah, he's trying to express this, you know. I am of you, but I am also much more than you. And you're obviously not of the school that believes that this isn't a symphony at all. It's a large symphonic poem with three bits tacked onto the end of it so that it can be passed off as a symphony.
No, I think there's some merit in that, but I really do, that it sits somewhere between the symphony and the symphonic poem, because it has a completely different structure. He himself even would have said that it was a hybrid symphony, that it sat somewhere between the two, that he was, you know, the whole Western classical tradition was being stretched here, I think, to breaking point in the way he wrote the piece. But for me, it's utterly captivating, I have to say. Absolutely.
Well, he believed that too. I mean, he wrote to his brother, and I always think it's hilarious that his brother's called Modeste, but obviously when you read it, it looks like Modest, and he sends the letter to him saying, you know, this is clearly the best work I've ever done. I'm thinking, to Modeste, Modest.
So what about the Glinka to Moss?
Ah, Glinka. I mean, I think it's the greatest piece of Irish classical music writing ever, perhaps, you know?
Enlighten me.
Well, obviously, the influence of John Field on Russian music is enormous. And, you know, we're here clinking away and having our modest repast in the interval in the John Field room. And John Field's is the unsung hero of Russian music.
That's true. I agree entirely with that. But what a piece. I mean, this is, if ever Fireworks was written for an orchestra, this is it. And remember last year we were talking about the fact that, you know, the overture had to fulfil various roles. As you said, it was like a film trailer. But also, of course, it was the opportunity for the orchestra to shine without all that distraction of stuff on the stage and the main opera itself, you know. And in this piece here, it just takes off at a furious rate and goes like that for forever after, you might say. There's a few slow passages as well. But I've listened to loads of recordings of it because it's so short, you can just keep listening. And you look at the time for each. It looks as if, sometimes I often wonder, are conductors involved in their own race against one another?
Definitely.
To play it. But the fastest I came across was that famous Russian conductor, Mravinsky, who took it at a shocking pace. And yet at the same time, with the Leningrad Orchestra, the sound is absolutely spot on and pure. There's no muddling going on.
That's
there.
That's somewhere about 3.5 minutes, I think.
I think it's a little bit slower than that. but then if you listen to one, I think it was Carry On with the Berlin, I can't remember now, but
like, it's about half a minute slower, and you notice it, you know. Now, if you hadn't heard the fast one, you'd say, God, that other one is fast. But when you see, like, it's the Usain Bolt version.
Now, I will say, in defence of Glink himself, of course, that he has a fantastic life that should really be a film by David Lean, because I'm always thinking that he is, you know, Omar Sharif. He's brought up by his grandmother. He's never let outside to play with the other boys. He's super wealthy.
He conducted the Surf's Orchestra on his parents' estate.
I always think that's a bad sign. I think it's a bad sign when you get all of your servant peasants in and force them to dance for you, you know? But yes, he did. He did that. And so he... We can also say, therefore, that he was probably familiar with what his servants were playing and performing, and that there's a rather melodramatic sort of idea that he never heard a drop of music except for the bell of the church off in the distance until he came to St. Petersburg. Well, I mean, it's meant to be, it's a rocket, you know, and it's meant to be fast. And, of course, he's hugely influenced by the Italian sort of movement there. I mean, and he you know, he comes, this, it feels Italianate, and it feels rock, you know, it rockets along. And, of course, you know, he himself was advised, as we know, by his doctors to... I wish doctors were a bit more like this these days, you know? So they said, Glinka, you need to go to Italy.
take a cure.
So he goes to Italy. But of course, you know, prior to this, we had the Italians coming to St. Petersburg, and, you know, there's a huge Italianate sort of upswing in St. Petersburg. And what surprises me is that, you know, you hear and you read so much about this being a failed opera, and that essentially that it was so Russian. It was, you know, it was essentially overlooked because the fashion for Italian opera had, you know, had really arrived at the Leningrad court.
And then, of course, the Bolshoi took it up as very much one of their works, and they've performed it like over 100 times, dozens and dozens of times in, I don't know, 6 or 8 different productions. So it has established itself there, but not really very much elsewhere. And but at the same time, the piece itself, I think that somebody once said about it, it had an energy worthy of Rossini. And that absolutely picks it up for me. That's just the sort of thing it should be. The opera itself had one of those hugely improbable stories.
Yes, I mean it's a shocker. I mean, it's an absolute shocker, which I don't think you get much of, thank goodness, in the overture. You know, and really, I suppose the magic element here. You know, I'm looking. You're always looking. Okay, what are they up to with the thematic sort of structure here? So we've got the magic of the evening, and what we have is essentially a kind of Wagner's Ring meets Cinderella meets Snow White.
Wait, slow down tomorrow.
Where we have Ludmilla spends the entire sort of opera being kidnapped by one crowd or another, being rushed to one exotic location or another, castles, tops of mountains, bottom of valleys, middles of forests. She falls asleep. She has to be woken by magic rings. I mean, the thing is just Disney would find it a little bit too challenging from a probability point of view.
But I think, isn't it, to us, couldn't it be summed up in those three famous words, love conquers all?
Yes, it certainly could be, you know, put in that phrasing. But I suppose it is full of magic. There's wizards in it. I mean, there's anything with wizards in it, always a great evening out, as far as I'm concerned.
Certainly, if anyone came along here hoping to maybe doze their way through, they were going to be woken by that.
Yes.
And they'll be kept awake by the Tchaikovsky as well.
Well, I had to look around just to make sure the old defibrillators were fully charged. Because it kicks off. Oh, it rums up there. And if you're even not quite prepared for it, it is a raucous beginning. As indeed is the beginning of the fourth symphony that we're now about to see. I mean, it's all very militaristic and martial and quite it rattles along in a very broad loud way.
Where do you stand, Tomas, on the violin concerto?
I stand at the gates of Vienna looking out at the Ottoman hordes charging towards us. That's where I stand. I mean, clearly, Alaturk sort of element, the Turkish element, is the significant part here. Which, I mean, here's the real problem. That the concept of Turkish is really code in many ways for the phrase barbaric at that time. And that what you also get is that kind of barbaric sort of folkloric element coming out in the final movement here now in Tchaikovsky's fourth as well. And then, of course, that, you know, the launch from in the Glinka there is also that kind of folkloric barbaric element to it as well. And then when you read all of those together, it's you get this magical feeling of sort of wanton anti-classicalism. I mean, that's really what's going on there. So it's interesting that you find this at the heart of Mozart. So I love this idea.
Thomas, you should have given the pre-concert talk. I love them all, sir.
It was grand now. It was grand now, Raymond.
But I have to say, Thomas, whatever about the fireworks in the third movement of the Mozart, I just think the middle movement is... If beauty has a sound, that's it. And if you hear it, you know, as we have just heard, a great performer doing it, you just get this serene, peaceful, beautiful sound coming out. I think it's a wonderful piece. Of course, you know it. He wrote the five violin concerti over the course of less than a year. And if you chart, if you listen to them, you can chart a development and a progress. He was only 19 years of age. The development from one to the next is extraordinary. And this one is the one which is seen as like pointing the way forward to the 19th century violin concerto. And it's the one, it's in the standard repertory now. It's played by just about everybody. It has a greater depth and weight to it. It's even been called, it has an almost an operatic quality to it. And he did things in it which he just hadn't attempted elsewhere. And of course, it leaves people like me saying, could he not have written three or four more of these? He'd reached this peak. He might have said, well, I have said everything I want to say in a violin concerto. It's all there now. But that middle movement for me is particularly special.
It is a fantastic piece. And again, it's a piece that you can imagine a violin virtuoso is going to want to perform. And particularly because of the unusual way we get the adagio coming straight in the first movement. And, you know, a soft, fantastic solo piece. It really allows you to shine in the middle of, and we have to get back to everyone else, but you get your moment in the sun very early on in this, and it's a way of seeing a magical performer.
Absolutely. Who we have here tonight, and who we are treasured, you might say, to have again next week. That's very unusual to us. Knowing the way these people move around the place, getting them to stand still sort of for 36 hours in one place is an achievement. They've got schedules like you wouldn't believe. Usually, as soon as they finish a concert, they're packing up, they're dashing maybe for an early flight, they're racing off to the next engagement. But Julian Racklin is playing here again next week. And he's staying in Dublin for the whole week. So he's being well occupied in 2 days' time. They're doing a studio concert in RTE. He's playing with members of the teaching staff, performing members of the teaching staff from the Royal Irish Academy of Music. And they're doing a magnificent chamber programme. Now, Tomás, I know you're tied up on Sunday, but it's being recorded for future broadcast. You'd be delighted to hear. They're doing Brahms' Piano Quintet and Beethoven's Septet. Now, let me see if I can think. It's for a horn, a clarinet, a bassoon, a violin, a viola, a cello, and a bass. Did I get that right?
Well done. Now, that's pretty good. Doing that offhand, no notes.
And it's called a septet, and yet it has an orchestral feel to it, obviously, because you've got almost a representative from each section, you might say. It's a magnificent piece of work. Really looking forward to that. Then he's working throughout the course of the following week. He's working with the chamber orchestra in the Academy Chamber Orchestra. I think he's also giving some master classes, and then we'll be seeing him here again next week. Fantastic to have somebody of that standard here in Dublin for a whole week. You know, he was born in Lithuania but moved to Vienna at a very, very young age, and that's where he, I suppose, really takes his influence from. And indeed, the violin he plays on, it's a Stradivarius, it's called the Ex Liebig, and it was owned in the 1960s, 70s by a man called Schneiderhan, who was the leader of the Vienna Philharmonic. Very famous man, played all around Europe. Fantastic instrument. But of course, we're talking about talent here tonight. Racklin also plays the viola and also conducts, as we're just about to see.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
I mean, one of the things I think that people liked about the concept of Turkish, and this Turkishness, and why even, you know, Mozart gave it this this nickname. I mean, a lot of these sort of nicknames that we see for classical pieces are given after, usually sometimes to make them a saleable item when they were being sold as sheet music. But Mozart in particular actually does this, and he puts says Turkish. But again, Alaturk is another phrase that he uses several times in his music. And the phrase, in fact, there's a strategic difference between Alaturk and Turkish. And it's partly to do with the fashionability of the Turkish idea of syncopation and these rhythmic sort of movements. And we see it with the violin, the way in which the violin in the final movement here en masse escalates and de-escalates, the kind of thing that we would see in horror films in some way, in contemporary horror films.
Horror film?
And is now indicative in our minds and sort of a signifier for trouble and worry in a thriller context. But what it meant for them, you know, Vienna in the 1780s, and this was written in 1775, and they were thinking about it, they were coming up to the 200th anniversary of the siege of Vienna by the Ottomans. And the Ottomans, and this thing went on for years. So when people think, you know, 1914, 18, our upcoming 1916 anniversary, are thinking, are we the people, are we just obsessed with this? Is it television? Is it the media that's driving this? No, people have been celebrating anniversaries of wars and battles and great things for generations. And there was a lot of planning went into this. So all around in the air was this idea of remembering that Vienna almost fell to the Ottoman Empire. And eventually they countered and they attacked back. And they chased the Ottomans back down sort of the Danube, essentially. But what happened then was the Turks then and the Ottoman Empire tried to sort of come back over the next 100 years by being great diplomats. And they were great diplomats. And one of the big things that they used in their diplomacy was their music. And the Janissary music, which is this kind of militaristic, rhythmic music, which was very unusual and exotic for people trained in the classical mode, which really emerges out of, you know, essentially religious music. And to have this kind of military martial music, which is dance music and very rhythmical and has lots of very interesting instruments and lots of knocks and cymbals and clicks and clacks and very syncopated, was very exotic. And Mozart, we have good evidence, strong evidence, that Mozart saw several of these Janissary Ottoman diplomatic bands playing. And that these became very, you know, these were very popular. And so it was always important to throw a little in, you know, into your own music.
I'm delighted you mentioned the siege of Vienna and the Ottomans there. however difficult the siege was for the citizens of Vienna, we can be thankful, I'm forever thankful, that the Ottomans left behind them the croissant. Because the croissant is the crescent moon.
Yes.
Left behind. And now if you go to any French boulangerie, there's always a section of viennoiserie. And viennoiserie refers to all those pastries and so forth. So we must celebrate certain amounts of it, and not just music that they brought us as well.
Some great pastries as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.